It's very sad and tragic, but when Education Cannot Wait was established, the estimated number of children and adolescents who had been deprived of a quality education amounted to 75 million. Then came COVID, and of course, new wars or escalating conflicts causing more displacement, more suffering, more disruption for the young generation. Education Cannot Wait undertook a new in-depth study and went even further to get an exact number, which was then endorsed by UN agencies and civil society's review panel. And then we realized it's no longer 75 million, it's 222 million children and adolescents. So we are speaking about absolutely dramatic increase. And as we move towards Sustainable Development Goals 2030, we realize that we are all falling behind. We are running a race. We have no option, but we have to win it.
Along the same lines, you recently returned from a UN mission to the border regions between Chad and Sudan. Can you tell us about that visit?
As you know, Sudan civil conflict broke out, and Education Cannot Wait. We move with speed. Very fast. It was a high-level mission, which I led together with UNHCR, UNICEF joined, Jesuit Refugee Service, civil society communities, and also in close contact and cooperation with the Ministry of Education in Chad, and obviously also the military for protection reasons. When we arrived, there were 30,000 refugees that had crossed the border from Darfur into eastern Chad. 3 days later, that had doubled to 60,000. And 90% of those refugees are children and women. Children in school age, including adolescents, amount to about 70%. So we are speaking about a huge tragedy, and this is real drama. The children that had just crossed the border with their families, and many of them also alone, being separated from their families, they were in a state of mental health concerns. Their eyes were hollow, they were very afraid, they reacted to any movement. So it took time just to build a sense of trust and confidence. And UNHCR and the Jesuit Refugee Service were doing a tremendously noble work on the ground, providing water, sanitation, World Food Program providing food, shelter from UNHCR. However, there's nothing for them. When we finally had got some confidence and sat with the children, we played a game. No education material, no trained teachers, all of that, of course, taken away from them. So a massive human tragedy. And if that does not move us to action and financial support, then what does move us to action? Mm-hmm. So Education Cannot Wait. We allocated an emergency allocation of $3 million to quickly get education up and running. The total requirement for these refugee children and youth is $8 million. So we put in, you know, about a third. And now we call on other donors to come in and top it up so that we fill that gap. Across all the five refugee hosting countries, Egypt, Central African Republic, Ethiopia, South Sudan, and then Chad, the requirement is about 25 million to be able to cater to their immediate needs in education. And that money is available. Now it's just a question of taking action. But it's very sad to see these children. And we know from, you come from Darfur, I've been to Darfur, I worked there many years. Their education prior was fairly okay, not the best, but they went to school at least. I've seen children coming from Central African Republic into DRC Congo, never set a foot in the school. But now it was completely, for these children from Darfur, disrupted. Nothing.
During your interactions with those kids, were you able to talk to them?
Yeah, I wouldn't ask the children about their fears because of child protection reasons, but I spoke to their mothers. Mm. So for the mothers, like any mother, they wanted their children, boys and girls alike, to get back to school as soon as possible. And in this regard, I should mention that during when the war and conflict in Darfur broke out in the mid-2000s, I was then working there, there were also refugee flows into Chad and elsewhere. And so we visited one of those refugee camps, and I met a young man from Darfur who had been a refugee for 18 years. On arriving, I mean, he had been provided with education so he could continue, and we have invested. And today, he is a well-educated teacher who teach refugee children as a teacher in school. So you either take that suffering and squeeze out of that pain productivity and beauty through education, which is the case of him, or you just let them sit there and get the basics of water and sanitation, and they will never, ever be able to empower themselves and change their lives.
What a moving story. Some people might argue that education might not be a priority for those living in emergency situations and protracted crisis. What do you say to those people?
Well, the first I would say, is that how you value your own children if they were to become refugees? Would you, no matter where you sit, whether you sit in New York or in Geneva or in any capital of the world, that if we ever were to come into crisis, education is not that important for my children? Of course not. That's all about empathy. Secondly, when you flee as a refugee, the average time that you are in refuge is 17 years. So basically, you're supposed to sit 17 years and do nothing with your life. If they have to wait until the crisis is over, then they will have to wait decades. That's just 222 million dreams destroyed, 222 million lives destroyed. Is that how we foresee the world? No, it cannot wait. And that's why we are called Education Cannot Wait.
Speaking of Afghanistan, following the Taliban takeover, you led the first all-women UN mission to negotiate for girls' right to education. And now girls across the country are denied their right to learn due to the ban on attending secondary school. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I worked in Afghanistan in the early 90s, so I have some degree of knowledge of the country and the people. And I have a great respect for the Afghan people, the long-suffering Afghan people. And when the Taliban took over this time, the UN, we can of course have informal talks with them. They are de facto government. But my colleagues and I, we sat down and said, but it's only men going there to talk to the Taliban. We need women to go and speak to the Taliban. So I said, well, I'm going to pull together a mission here now of women. So we traveled to via Islamabad, met with the Minister of Education, the de facto, and his team, and spoke to girls' right to education. And I felt very comfortable doing so, partly because I've lived there in Afghanistan, and partly because the right to an education for every Afghan girl through secondary school outweighs any fears that anyone should feel when you represent human rights. Whatever comes, we have to speak up for them and with them. And interestingly, well, we were told that the plan was being developed to get a different curriculum in. So I asked them, when is that plan going to be ready? And they said, well, we are working on it. Well, it has to happen fast, with speed. And then I spoke with other members of the cabinet team. And there were officials who came to me and said, we are very concerned because we have daughters too. And we want our daughters to go to school. One of them was very desperate, and this is Taliban. Some of them were Mujahideen during the conflict with Russia, Soviet Union back then. They wanted their girls to go to school. I don't think that the decision, this is my guess, not to allow go to school is a political decision. I think it is severely screwed up religious decision. I believe, I'm a believer, but not understanding Islam. Because in Islam, education is a knowledge, is at the core. You open the Quran, it says read. It doesn't say boys should be reading. It says read, meaning boys and girls.